We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we work and live, the Awabakal and Worimi people, and pay our respects to elders past and present. We celebrate the stories, culture, and traditions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders of all communities who also work and live on this land.
You're listening to Boob to Food, the podcast with Luca McCabe and Kate Holm. There is so much noise in the parenting space.
And we don't mean the tantruming toddler. We understand it can feel confusing, conflicting, and overwhelming.
That's why we are bringing our years of experience as a midwife, nutritionist, and naturopath.
And of course, mums.
So that you can confidently navigate the roller coaster of motherhood from boob to food and beyond.
Each week, you'll hear practical wisdom, expert advice, and inspirational stories of other mums in the depths of this parenting journey.
Let's dive in. Today's episode has been brought to you by Ergo Pouch.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Boob to Food, the podcast. How was your romantic weekend away, Kate?
It was so lovely. Night away. Yeah, I know. One night away. We took just Immy and my in-laws stayed with the big kids. So that, like, I was talking to my sister about it and she's like, one child is basically no children. Like, totally, especially one baby who's not yet on the move. It was really, really nice. It was Mike's birthday a couple of weeks ago, and then a few days later is our wedding anniversary. So I'd booked a surprise night away, which is why I couldn't talk about it on the last podcast intro. It was just so nice to have that time to slow down. And we went to a very secluded, quiet, like forest retreat basically, and just ate some yummy food and enjoyed each other's company and relaxed. And yeah, they had an outdoor bath. So had like, although Mike had the relaxing bath the night before, and then I had the like stressful morning bath when we also were like, oh shit, Emmy needs a sleep. So we probably need to start packing up to check out. But it was lovely for the 5 minutes that I got to spend in there. It definitely made me realize that we need to do it more often as well. Although I did come back to, particularly Bowie punished me for going away. She was quite out of sorts. Everyone was very emotional, and Jude actually, he was quite emotional too. He'd missed me a lot, which we've had a couple of nights away now and usually it's been fine. I wonder if it's also, you know, that time apart when he's at school, which he's really loving. And then, yeah, this was the first time he was emotional and didn't want us to go. And then when I got back, he was, yeah, quite upset too and ended up staying up really late, I think, trying to make up for that time that we were away. But it was still worth it. It was really nice.
Maybe you just need to do it more.
Yeah, get them used to it.
Get them used to it.
I don't know. My in-laws sometimes listen to this podcast. I'm not sure if they're on board for more. Steve and Kathy, if you're listening, let me know how often we can go away.
Oh, and how's your cat?
Oh, my gosh. The cat has had a permanent relocation to my sister-in-law's house because that whole event was just incredibly stressful, and he's now had his tail entirely amputated, which I haven't seen him in the flesh. I've only seen a photo. It's interesting to say the least. I was looking at this photo that Emily, my sister-in-law, sent me. I was like, oh, they've left the wound really open. And then I'm like, oh no, that's his butthole. It's now just like fully exposed to the world. But apparently he's recovering fine, and he honestly has a death wish. He was put in a collar, like, to, you know, they have to stop them from licking the wound. But it was like this kind of soft collar jacket looking thing, and Emily popped out for 10 minutes to get some kitty litter, and by the time she got home, he'd managed to get one whole arm through the collar and had it like stuck around his waist, and she had to cut it off him because she couldn't get it off. And so now he's in like a hard plastic collar and, yeah, probably regretting and yet another bad life decision. But anyway, I feel like
sounds good that you've relocated him.
Oh, yes. Stressful. Very stressful. I had for years been on the campaign for getting a puppy, but I have decided to park that campaign until much later in life because I feel like I haven't recovered from that whole experience.
Oh gosh.
Yes. And how has your week been?
Oh, I was going to say, has the rest of your week been okay?
The rest of my week has been fine. It's, still just school, which Jude's still loving. So that is really positive from my end, still navigating a three-year-old, which, you know, she's a joy. She's definitely having some feelings around all of the adjustments in her life. And I can see that, like, she misses Jude terribly while he's at school. So then I think, yeah, that's a big part of the increase in our tantrums and emotions. We got a new neighbor as well, which was, we were really scared when that happened because we thought it might be a developer and they'd, you know, build a million townhouses right up against our fence line. But it's actually a lovely lady with also a three-year-old daughter who is also lovely. And so I'm stoked about that. We've got this really nice little community of neighbors and kids. And yeah, so the rest of my week has been really, really good. How about you? Good. What's happening in your life?
Yeah, I started Fight Fit.
What's Fight Fit?
Fight Club. Fight Club. I started.
Is this because you got inspired after your jiu-jitsu moves while you were away?
Yeah, if anyone listening, like I love working out, and I do F45 most mornings. But I've been really wanting to learn how to fight.
Okay. Don't anyway. Get on Luca's bad side.
I know. Well, I don't know if I'm not like an aggressive person, but my husband does jiu-jitsu, and so if he ever kind of like practices some moves on me, I get all fired up and like really enjoy it. But I don't want to get hurt. And so I just want to be the one that punches things and just, I don't know, unleash my, I had like this from Holly as a party who's been on the podcast before. We did this psychic, no, it wasn't that. What's it called? Astrology. You bought it for me. Astrology thing. And anyway, basically it was kind of like interpreting what your sign is. And one of my things was that I have one fire. I'm probably saying this so wrong if Holly's listening. I have one fire sign, but my one is that I need to let it out in a physical sense. Mm-hmm. So some people can talk or cry or whatever. I have to like punch things. Mm-hmm. Anyway. And I was like, that is me. Anyway, so I started Fight Fit last night. My arms are so sore, like my wrists. I feel like I've broken both of them. I could not even drive home. Anyway, it was so fun. So that's exciting. And other than that, well, we're going camping tomorrow. It's Easter this weekend. So
we can expect rain.
Yep. So literally as we're talking, the weather has changed and gone rainy. So that's great. It's Florence's 6th birthday as well. And it's also my mum's 60th and my brother's birthday. So,
oh, wow. So many birthdays.
All born the same weekend. So, yeah, we're going away for Easter to our friend's property and then we'll go home and celebrate my mum and my brother and Florence. So that's exciting. But I think the biggest thing is we've transitioned Will to a big boy bed, which is so bittersweet. I actually like, I'm not sentimental, as you know, and I don't really cry, but I cried getting rid of the cot. Like, it really shocked me. Like, I didn't cry, but I got a tear.
Just one tear.
I welled up slightly, but I don't know. I've gotten rid of all of his baby stuff and nothing's affected me, but I think because the cot has gone through all three children and they're in a cot for so long, so I feel like there's just so many memories like rocking around that cot, and, you know, putting them down and like commando crawling out of the room or just so many things that I just think like, oh, I don't know, it really hit me saying goodbye. And I gave someone, picked it up off Marketplace, I gave it away for free. But when they came, I was like, oh, I felt a bit sad. Aww. But, you know, I don't have to miss him that much because the transition has not gone well to a big boy bed.
Oh no.
He's been in our bed every single night. So that's great. I'm glad I spent all that money on a nice, beautiful bed because he won't sleep in it because we transitioned him now. He's turning 3 1st of June because he was climbing out of his cot constantly. It's like putting him to bed, he would climb out 7 times. And so we thought, might as well just do the transition now because it's not going to be any different.
Yeah.
He's still going to climb out regardless. So let's just transition him. We got a beautiful bed from the Perk shop, which is so nice. And it's like low and like a toddler bed, or like a floor bed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's great. So if he does fall out, it's literally on the floor, which is amazing. And it has these adjustable legs that you can then put up as they grow, which is really cool. It's really, really lovely. But, yeah, he has been in our bed every single night. So he's still like getting out of bed like the normal when we put him in the bed. But then literally from 10 p.m. he's in our bed every night. He just walks in. And I would like to say that I like it, but I he doesn't sleep. He's not a – none of my kids like – except for Flynn actually, sorry. He sleeps like a corpse. But the other two just roll around all night and like he has to check I'm there every – feels like every 10 minutes. Probably not, but like I feel like I'm just being like tapped all night to check I'm there and he has to be on top of me and oh, I'm really tired. Yeah, I know I can't say that to you because you have a new baby, but I'm like – I feel like I was getting sleep and now I'm not. And now I'm like, the cot's gone and I can't get it back. Oh, I've regretted my life decision.
Oh, no.
I'm like, I can't put a lock on his room.
No.
I don't know. I'm like, maybe I need to, when he comes in, like actually go put him back into bed because I can't even be bothered. I just ignore him and he'll climb in. But then I think, then am I going to get in a habit of like lying in his bed, which I don't want to do that either.
Well, yeah, Mike sleeps in Bowie's bed. So I actually woke up this morning and Mike was still in bed with me. And I'm like, my initial reaction is, oh no, like, why is he here? Thinking, yeah, why didn't she wake up? But anyway, she just hadn't woken up. But yes, we do play the musical beds. And I don't know if that's just a rite of passage in itself. I don't tend to do the like, you know, bribery as a motivating thing. But Jude, when I was pregnant with Immy and we just knew I couldn't have three kids in the bed with me and one of them being a newborn. So I was like, we have to have Jude sleeping in his bed. So his incentive was that if he could sleep in his bed, I think I said 10 nights, wake up in his own bed in the morning, then he could get a new scooter. And I think we got to 5 nights and I, like, he was taking it so seriously. Like, he's a real rule follower and like he really wanted to do it well. That after 5 nights, I was like, oh, let's just go and get your scooter. But that was it for him. He's like, now I don't even think he wakes up at all. It would be very, very rare. Bowie, weirdly, because we have always co-slept and I've never owned a cot. So she's in, when Jude went into his bed, she felt really motivated to go into her own bed as well. And even though she could just get up and walk in, she not once has done that. Mm-hmm. She'll just instead be like, Dad, like screaming, which is possibly worse because it's absolutely terrifying to wake to this like top of the lung scream.
There's a very terrifying to wake up to a little face that you didn't know was there. Like sometimes he climbs in, I don't even, I'm in, because it's 10 p.m. I've sort of in that real deep sleep. Mm. And then I wake up at like 11 and his face is there and it scares the shit out of me. It's like, when did you get in here? But you know when they walk in and they're just staring at you and you like, you can just see them stare. Oh, it looks like a horror movie. Anyway, I know. I'm like, it's always this in parenting how you're like, do I surrender to this because it's just a phase that will end and inevitably I know it will end, but it's like, how long will this phase go for and should I do something about it because I am getting really sleep deprived? Yeah. Like I'm honestly waking up so much. I feel like I'm not going into a deep sleep and I'm one of those people that's really conscious that they're there. I just sleep light anyway. So anyway,
Oh,
I'll let everyone know how it goes. But motto of the story, keep him in a cot as long as you can.
With
at least
a lead
now
on
he's
it.
In a bed. No. At least he's in a bed now. So like if I have to lie in there, it's not like when I was having to climb into the cot, which I had to do a few times, which is never very fun.
Yeah. Can you outsource this task to Jesse or does Will not want that?
No, he would only want me.
Yeah.
All my kids only want me. Like, can one of them be a dad's child, please? But no, thankfully I wasn't sleep deprived at the time of recording this episode. So on today's episode we have the privilege of interviewing the amazing Professor Kelvin Kong all about our children's ear health. We talk all about grommets, ear infections, sleep and more. Kelvin is a proud Warramai man and the current 2023 NAIDOC Person of the Year. He graduated from the University of New South Wales and he's Australia's first Indigenous surgeon.
Kelvin is an otolaryngology head and neck surgeon, and I think I should win points for being sleep deprived and saying that word, here in Newcastle, and a fellow of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. As you'll hear in the episode, Kelvin is really passionate about addressing the disparity in health outcomes between Indigenous and non-Indigenous children. Each year, he spends a portion of his time working in and for remote Indigenous communities, providing access to quality healthcare that would otherwise be limited or completely unavailable. This includes visiting the Kimberleys each year to perform specialist consultations and surgery.
I'm really privileged to get to call Kelvin and his family friends of ours, and he's honestly one of the most passionate and dedicated and busy people that I know. But he always makes so much time and space for his kids and his family. He's amazing, and we really, really hope that you love this episode.
Well, welcome to Boob to Food, the podcast, Professor Kelvin Kong. We are very excited to have pinned you down today to pick your brain about all things ear, nose and throat problems and lots of things relating to kids. But before we dive into that, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, who's in your family and the very many things that you do?
Yeah, sure. Firstly, thanks for being so patient with me today. For you guys listening, I've just been operating and these guys stay back another 2 hours as I say hello. So thank you so much and apologies. My name's Kelvin Kong. I'm a Warramai man, a proud Warramai man, and I grew up in Shoal Bay. I've been lucky enough to finish my surgical studies. I'm now an ear, nose and throat surgeon, and I work at John Hunter Hospital. I'm proud to be back here on our kind of country close by, and I'm really lucky in being able to help many people in different ways. I have a myriad of different roles, so I don't know where I start there. I do a bit of research, I do a bit of operating, I do some paediatric stuff, I do adult stuff, I do some outreach work, I work with government, I work with policy, but I think my biggest role is being a home person and a father of three beautiful but challenging children, challenging in the nicest way possible. No, seriously, they're absolutely wonderful and beautiful, Kiara. My son's now 8. My daughter's 7 and my other daughter's 5, and they are so much fun. And so that probably takes up most of my thinking time.
Yeah.
Just trying to see the different world that they live in compared to what I lived in is wonderful. So
that's a long list of things to do.
I feel like that was a very humble list of what you actually do. So we'll have to add in your official bio because that was a humble overview, I think. You're definitely the busiest person that I know. I don't know how you do it all, honestly, and still show up and be a parent and a great dad. So
hats
off to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're always at the school events. You always seem to be there, and I think I don't know how you manage to do it all.
So I think it's important though, isn't it?
Your kids go to school together.
Yes.
It's fun to see that kind of stuff and seeing them grow and how fast has it gone?
Like, I know.
We blink and they're already, year two, year three, and then suddenly they're in high school, suddenly they're gone. So I try and relish as much as possible. And when you see kids, certainly the kids you look after, and it's probably a bad thing to say, but you're always, you're feeling for them and their struggles. And so, you know, when you go home and have a really tough case, the kids are lucky enough to get an extra cuddle and they just kind of look at it strangely, but you realise how lucky that we are.
Yeah, absolutely. So true. Can you explain what an ENT doctor is and what you do?
Yeah, so it means that we've finished medicine, so we're a doctor, and then you get the privilege of studying for another few more years. To be able to study in the science of ear, nose and throat. The formal word is otorhinolaryngology. Oto for ear, rhino for nose, laryngology of the throat. And it's one of those really fascinating areas where you delve into some of the smallest parts of the body, but I think, and obviously I'm a bit biased with this, the most beautiful parts of the body, which actually affect the way in which you develop, grow and interact in society. One of the beautiful things about the work that I do is that it's both paediatric, meaning kids, as well as adults. So you get this really broad range of patients from cradle to deathbed, and I think that's really enhancing for your practice, but also really beautiful to see those different stages of lives that people go through and be able to help or be involved in their life in some capacities is wonderful.
How did you get into that area of work? What was the what drew you to it?
I was I was lucky in that when I was in medical school, I had the opportunity of working with many different people, but one of the guys I work with did remote work. And so I was able to go to some communities, also some of the regional communities, and just see the ability of giving back and how wonderful it was to give back. And those who have done as simple as donated some money or donated clothes or, you know, when you're giving back to people who are less fortunate, it just makes you feel good and actually want to contribute and do more. The second thing he did was some really fun, quirky, amazing surgery. And, you know, when we're in a world where we're always complaining about the things we don't have, Australia has one of the best health systems, and I say this with the hand on my heart and in some of the things you do. So the complex airway surgery that he did, the ear surgery that he did, and so he was in both worlds where he could actually contribute to society and in a meaningful way, but also in a selfish way do some really cool, fun operations. And, you know, there's not many jobs where you go to work, you're getting in pyjamas, we call them scrubs, and listen to cool music and hang out with some really fun people and help people. Like that's a pretty unique opportunity to do that. And so I think for that it was really empowering for me. And certainly growing up where we faced a lot of health issues, to be on the other side, to be able to help and realise what kids go through and feel that pain that kids go through, is wonderful to be able to help out from there. So, and I fell into it. I was really lucky. I met some wonderful mentors. I had some great friends who were very supportive and managed to get through. So here so I am.
Cool. I just think, like, I'm so squeamish. So hearing you talk about doing surgery in that way, I can really appreciate it and I can totally see it and hear it in the way that you speak. But for me, I'm like, oh my gosh, I couldn't think of anything worse. I stay in my pyjamas, but I get to work in an office at home and do things to help people.
It's a weird concept though, because I agree with you. To think that you get an instrument or a knife and interfere with someone in a weird way, but then when you're actually doing it, you don't realise you're doing it. So, you know, some operations you get in there and you'll be an hour into the operation and you look up and you realise it's an hour or 2 hours past and you haven't even thought anything else because you're just so into what you're doing at the time. And it's just a weird feeling because suddenly you've done something, accomplished something, and then you're feeling good about it. And that's pretty cool. Mm. But it is squirmish when I think about it afterwards. I think, oh, that's gross.
While we were waiting, I was just asking Luca if it smells like when you do surgeries.
Depending on what you're doing. Some, like, the diversity of the operations we do range from, you know, on the weekend I was on call and there was a couple of people came with bad infections. And so when you go on to drain those infections, you know, you think about the Dr. Pimple Popper, it's that times 20 and you're in someone's nose or throat. Oh, or
or, you know, I get really stuck watching those videos.
Or no. Pulling out, you know, we pulled out a chicken bone that someone swallowed on the weekend and so you pull it out and you think, mate, chew next time. That's pretty gross. But most things don't. Most of the other things are pretty clean operations.
Well, you've even done a surgery or maybe more in utero, haven't you? I think it's pretty amazing.
Well, it's pretty fun that you can do it. And then go back to how we are in this world and what we're doing. So, you know, the other week we operated on a four-day-old baby who wasn't breathing well. But the fact that you can diagnose things in utero and to be able to help in that aspect, and the one you're talking about was a case where you can't deliver a baby that's going to be obstructing their mouth, and often it would be considered a stillbirth. But with MRIs and utero and ultrasound, you actually plan and stage what you're going to do. And so to anaesthetise a baby is hard work because you need to put drips in and all those things, and you can't in the baby because they're all slimy and all those things. And so if you just deliver the baby's head and shoulder via cesarean section, you buy yourself 60 minutes to do an operation on the mouth or that. And so you run all the anaesthetics through the mum, and so the mum then runs all the anaesthetics through the placenta. And so if you deliver the baby, then it triggers all the appropriate hormones to push everything out and cut the placenta off. But if you leave the baby in the womb and just take the head out and one shoulder, then it buys you that time. And it's fascinating too, because suddenly your clock starts at 60 minutes and it's bang, let's see what everyone's on.
How and stressful.
When, it's funny because it's fun. It's fun. And, you know, one of our friends was one of the midwives in there and you know, I was just beaming with excitement with this case and she's just looking at me like, you're a weirdo.
You know what, I can semi-relate not at all to doing surgery. Like, can you? No, nothing. No, I cannot relate to that. No. I used to get really – this is not at all in the same ballpark. I used to get really excited doing exams. I found that really fun. The clock starts and I'm like, I'm on the clock now. I've got to accomplish this. Like,
we need people in all aspects. I always look at my accountant and I think, thank God you like this because I do not. So we all need something. We're all made differently, thankfully. But what do you see, like, apart from surgeries, what are you seeing as, like, the most common ailments in your practice with our paediatric, like, demographic? What are you seeing coming through?
By far the most common thing is otitis media, so ear problems and ear infections. Mm. And probably the second thing is sleep troubles or tonsillitis. And for newborns is babies trying to get good sleep, which is probably everyone's heartache.
Next minute everyone's going to be calling you.
If you're actually
and it's hard, and it's hard. It's really hard because that's the ultimate thing that you want, particularly for your baby, is be able to sleep well, be able to grow well. And I think a lot of the time when we're seeing that, and we inherently do it, that you want your baby to excel and do well. And so when your baby's starting to fall on those milestones of not talking, of not walking yet, and everyone else's kid's walking and talking, or they keep getting infections, you keep going to the emergency department, you're tired already, you can't sleep, they're going all through the night. It's a horrible, horrible existence, really, really hard. So I think for us, being able to help in that aspect makes a big difference. And when you see kids come in that start talking, when you see kids coming back in and they're laughing and hanging out and doing things, but also we talk about the education and speech and language as being our milestone, but the reality is how do you engage a kid to have fun at home so that when you're at home with them, you can read a book, you can laugh with them, you can tell jokes to them, not that they're going, huh, what, and you're getting frustrated. And so rather than getting frustrated, then you actually enjoy them, and I think that's a big part of it.
And what would be some red flags then if, like, I guess on the hearing issues that your child might be struggling or needs to be assessed?
One of the things I've always tried to propagate in all my conversations, lectures is every child, every opportunity, every ear. And that's one thing I really want to hone into everyone listening, but also to our primary practice in our healthcare network. It doesn't have to be a doctor. Mm. Any healthcare professional that gets in contact with you should look in the ear inherently. If we're doing that, then we start knowing what a normal ear looks like, but more importantly, then we can pick up things very quickly from that point of view. For parents then, if you're worried about any speech concerns, if you're worried about ear tugging, if you're worried about walking and balance, my middle child had lots of balance issues when she was growing up and there was all the ear disease problems, they're kind of flags that immediately make you think. But the reality is if you're worried about anything, see a doctor and ask them. I think far too often we're worried and go, oh, they'll be right and not worry about it. 0 to 3 is the most important age to get ear help in, 0 to 3. In the old days, we used to talk about when they start school, get a hearing test, make sure they're okay. You've missed the boat by school. So if you're starting kindergarten and you're not hearing or you're not speaking well, then you've got a lot of work to do. Can be done, but it's a hard work from there. So 0-3 is when you're going to do it. And that's really hard because there's so many things going on in your life and you're not sleeping forever. And so suddenly you're starting to realise that. So I was talking to aunties, uncles, cousins, daycares, other friends with kids, having your playgroups. And the playgroup's a really good idea in sense of just seeing where your milestones are. And, you know, you might not like the mums you're hanging out with, but you get a quick idea of how your kid's doing in a broad sense, and you can actually get the help you need to. So I think for me the red flags would be just being aware of perceptions of how they're growing and developing.
I've been looking at my almost 3.5-year-old recently. She's so loud, and I've always just thought, like, she's quite an assertive, like, strong personality little girl. But recently I was like, should I be getting her ears tested? Is she loud because she can't hear us or can't hear herself?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the classic example of that, which is actually a reflex, is that when you're on the phone and you're in a noisy environment, you'll naturally talk louder because you can't hear. Mm-hmm. And so kids would generally raise their voice up. And then say, a simple hearing test is all you need to get. Yeah. And you then clear it and say, yep, that's okay. Mm. The only warning I say is that ear disease can be quite fluctuant, meaning that it comes and goes. So there might be times where they're loud or not. Coming into winter now, we'll find that kids start getting all the ear troubles very commonly and very frequently. And so we just want to make sure that they're progressing well. And the other way you can tell that is whether her vocabulary and articulation of sounds is quite good. And if that's good, then you're okay to kind of relax, not worry about that.
She's pretty good. She's pretty good. She's never had an ear infection. She's just strong, then.
I love it.
But, yeah, it did just occur to me because I was like, you're much louder than my elder.
But you don't, and that's probably a point you've raised, is you don't have to have ear infections. So most kids that look after with ear disease don't get ear infections.
Yeah, okay.
The majority of kids I see have language or speech issues, and so when you get fluid built up in your ear, that's where you actually get the hearing loss. Hearing, speech and language are far more important than infections.
Yeah.
Because infections I can treat with antibiotics, don't care. Mm. But language I can't reverse, so you need to make sure you get onto it from that point of view.
Yeah. Mm. I used to always think that Florence had hearing issues because she just always, what
you say?
I was heard always, what you say? But then as soon as you go in the pantry, try and hide and ruffle a bag of chips, who appears? Florence. Oh. Like, your hearing is totally fine. But I feel like that's selective hearing, isn't it? So we can't really diagnose that.
You can't help that. You can't help selective hearing.
But so you talked about like early intervention being important, and this is obviously so that they have, I guess, no issues learning speech and development. Is that right? Is that why it's so important, or is it more to do with like that the operation's harder later or anything like that?
No, far from that. It comes down to a basic principle of growing in a normal environment and having that speech and language acquisition. Mm-hmm. The further you get behind initially, the longer the trouble you're going to get long term. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to be very careful from that point of view. So for me, going back to what I was saying before, is that if you get onto it early and quickly, then you're not worrying about it down the track. Yeah. And so it makes it a lot easier for us to be able to assess the kid quickly, see whether they need intervention. It doesn't always equate to surgery. It might just mean a bit of support, some nose sprays, some nose blowing, some balloon blowing, things like that. And I think that's our thing, is that often people think it needs an operation. It doesn't need an operation all the time. It's just making sure you're on track. Speech pathology might be their intervention. Mm-hmm. It might be some behavioural techniques. It might be in your house, it's a loud house, and you do need to tame down some of those things and get them more sensitive to sounds. So there's a whole different array of those. But again, you don't have to get down to the nuances of that. It's just making sure that your child is meeting the milestones that they require to meet at their age.
We'll be back after this short break. Today's episode has been brought to you by Ergo Pouch.
I don't know about you, Kate, but one of my biggest stresses when it comes to my little ones going to sleep is wondering if they're going to be too hot or too cold. Honestly, the amount of times that I check them is unbelievable because I hate being too hot or too cold at night. And so, I don't know, we just have this big fear around it. So that's why I love Ergo Pouch, because they have their dog rated, not only their bags, which are amazing and I've used for all three of my kids, but their pajamas are dog rated too. So it just takes so much of that thinking out of it, especially now Will's in his big boy bed and kicks the blankets off. If I know he's got his dog rated pajamas on, I know he's going to be warm.
Or anything to preserve your sleep if you're not getting woken up with it.
That's why I'm so worried about it. I'm like, will you wake up hot? Will you wake up cold? I feel like it's one of those hidden stresses that parents don't talk about.
Yeah, totally.
The baby's temperature at night.
Well, you can outsource the worry and just go to Ergo Pouch because, yes, as you said, both their bags and their pajamas are TOG rated, and the PJs are so cute as well. They're really nice patterns. They're like, my kids absolutely love them. They're so excited when they get to see their new PJs for winter. So yeah, I love them on that front too.
If you want to take the stress out of your baby's sleep time, then you can use the discount code BOOB2FOOD for 20% off. The code is valid until the 15th of April, and you can visit ergopouch.com.au to view the range today.
Now let's get back to today's episode.
To document the loud house, this might be really controversial, but I remember your wife saying to me once, and it always stuck in my mind, and I've never asked you about it, your thoughts on the white noise machines.
I don't mind it. So white noise machine is not a bad thing. So if I go back the other way, people in our community suffer badly from tinnitus. I don't know if you know tinnitus. Tinnitus is that kind of annoying noise you get in the back of your throat, in the back of your mind. And your mind and your brain hears everything, a lot of things. Over your lifetime, you learn good noises and you put out bad noises and you enjoy different things. So our interpretation of music is very different to our children's interpretation of music, which is very different to our grandparents' interpretation of music, so that you start learning what you like and what you don't like. And a good example of that is when you go to a friend's house in Sydney and they're on the Pacific Highway, there's cars going down, Tom, you're going, how do you sleep in this house? And they go, I didn't even notice it. Because their brain has I've pushed away all that sound and has brought in all the good sound. Similarly, someone's got a grandfather clock in the house and you hear those chimes and they're dinging every hour and they go, how do you put up with that? And they don't notice it. It's because their brain's learnt to live and push out the bad noise. So when you come to white noise, often it's in children who live in a noisy environment or an environment where they're not necessarily used to. And so putting noise in the background distracts from the other noises. So it's something that they have as a constant. So whether you're sleeping in that room, your parents' house, someone else's house, you put that noise in there, they know that that means sleep. So it's triggering the brain to go, this is sleep time, and it puts out that noise. So it varies on your child from time to time. Some people say it's bad because when you don't have it, your kid can't sleep because they're not used to a natural environment. Some kids can sleep through parties. Other kids can't sleep when you just drop a coin. So it depends. And I think those who have more than one children will probably realise that your first kid gets the quietest room. Your third kid, you're lucky if you remember their name.
Yes. Well, I remember Kiara saying something about, you know, that your kids didn't have them because it's good to have quiet, I guess, for their ears. But
loud noises, I think for Lewis, I think we did try it for a little while there because he wasn't sleeping that well. But I think it became too cumbersome or we didn't really like. Loud noise in kids is probably a bad thing.
Because some people turn those white noise machines, like I remember going to my sister-in-law's house once and I was like, is it raining? What's that sound? And
it was quite the loud, white noise machine. Certainly loud's not, because they put it next to the ears as well. So, yeah, no, I don't like that.
Yeah, okay. So if we have one not too quiet loud, noise, just a quiet. Okay, that's good to know.
On the topic of sleep, you mentioned that some of your work and the surgeries and things that you would do relate to sleeping issues in kids. What would be, like, what are you seeing there? What are the common
presentations? The commonest thing you're seeing is snoring, and snoring is so prevalent in our communities. Snoring, I don't mind. There's a whole array of different kind of sleep behaviours, sleep disorder breathing, obstructive sleep apnea, and snoring are all kind of in the same mix. And there's a whole array of severity. Simple snoring, we don't care. Simple snoring is great. It's annoying for us. And probably a lot of our partners have simple snoring where it's not really worrisome, but it just annoys us. And the other spectrum is sleep apnea, which is quite dangerous. Kids need sleep. Kids need lots of sleep. And so it's really important to make sure they're getting good sleep. Tonsils and adenoids are probably the commonest cause of these bad sleep. And when you've got large tonsils and large adenoids, it blocks off the airway. And when it blocks off the airway, they're not breathing well. So when they're trying to breathe in, they're sucking in a lot of air. And they're sucking in harder because they're not getting past that obstruction, and that's when you get everything moving around, which is causing the snoring noises. That's where we want to do something about it, because that can lead to poor concentration, again, poor learning, poor difficulty in actually going to school. Concentration becomes hard, mood swings, bedwetting, grinding teeth, all those things are related to a bad night's sleep.
How can you tell just from a normal person what is simple snoring or what is sleep apnea?
It's really hard to know exactly what is. One of the beautiful things about the world we live in is mobile phones. The smartphones allow us to record. And so we record. So most patients that come in and see me will have a recording of their sleep and be able to see both the way in which they're sleeping, the position they're sleeping, but also the sounds they're getting in there. So all those things kind of contribute to it. The most dangerous signs of snoring would be where there's pauses in the snoring. So you hear the snoring come in, pause, and I'll come back out again. That's probably by far the most dangerous. The longer that pause, the more dangerous from that point of view. When you're generally snoring, it's just loud in and out snoring. That's probably not so bad from that point of view. Again, it's not something that's hard and fast, and so therefore you shouldn't try and diagnose it by Googling what your child's doing, but rather seek and go see your local doctor, go see your local healthcare professional so they can actually say, oh, yeah, that's something you don't have to worry about. And those who are worried, get a sleep study organised or come and see an ENT so you can work that out. And trying to work out whether that's good or bad will then help you decide whether or not you should have intervention.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same with open mouth breathing at night as well?
Yeah, so your tonsils and adenoids are very similar. Mm-hmm. When your adenoids are big in a kid, it blocks off your whole nose. So when you block off your nose, you can't breathe. So when you can't breathe through your nose, you compensate by opening your mouth. Open mouth position, and often the kids will come and they talk about sleeping with their head back, mouth open, or bum in the air, head down first, because it actually makes the tonsils fall forward and they can open up their airway and breathe better. When you breathe through your mouth, you're obviously making noises. You have the pauses, which are obviously dangerous. It means that your mouth dries out, so you increase your risk of dental caries and teeth issues. People argue that it changes the shape of your face because you're not breathing through your nose. And then that also leads to poor sleep, sweats, movement in beds, and then you're waking up cranky and tired. And so the kid might be in bed for 12 hours, but they're probably actually getting about 3 or 4 hours good sleep. And so therefore you start saying, well, hang on, they're in bed all the time. So you've got to be very careful in what you're seeing. So when you see all those positions, they're all cues for us. So if your kid's noisy, they're all over the bed, hot sweats, mouth open, they're things I'd be saying talk to your doctor about.
Yeah. Okay.
I've always been curious about how they would conduct a sleep study for young children. I just think even for me personally, or maybe this is the difference, maybe a child wouldn't even think about it, but I think I don't know if I could fall asleep if I knew that I was going to be.
And it's a common problem because often when kids come back from a sleep study, the parents go, that was the best sleep they had, or they didn't sleep at all because they had all these wires and things on them. But we've got to try and articulate what we're doing sleep studies for. If you take a good history and try and work out what's going on, you'll generally know where you're sitting.
Yeah.
And so most kids you can work out, don't need anything done, don't worry about it, that's fine, or we should be actually doing something. The kids that I tend to send for sleep studies are where I'm worried about it and the parents are not. And so you might get one parent saying, yeah, I'm keen, one parent saying, I'm not, and say, look, don't worry about that, let's get a sleep study and we'll see which way they fall, and I don't mind that. And you get a hunch on where that sits and that's okay. The second reason why I'd get a sleep study is that if it's really severe sleep apnea, syndromic kids or other, you know, preemie kids, all those kind of things, then your post-op care or your management after the operation is very different, and you need to make sure then you're in intensive care or they might need to stay in hospital for a couple of days to make sure they're breathing well. And so they're the kids I want to know the answer of how bad it is so I know where I'm going to manage them in the post-op period. Whereas most kids, day surgery these days, in and out, it's not too bad. So that's the majority of kids. So it's very hard to get a sleep study, so I'm very careful about the indications for sleep study.
Yeah.
When you say day surgery for this, are you talking about tonsillectomy or adenoidectomy?
Yeah. Adenoidectomy.
Adenoidectomy.
Adenoidectomy. 7 p.m. My brain's not working. Is that generally what you would do?
Yeah. So there's the tonsils. The tonsils and the adenoids are the same thing. They're lymphoid tissue which help us develop. They expand and get bigger as you're growing to a crescendo, and they start shrinking down again. So the peak is around 3 years of age or thereabouts, and they kind of get a bit bigger and they shrink back down again. So around the age of 6, 7, 8, they start growing out of it. And so if they're still getting lots of issues after that, then you probably need to do something. But also then it's trying to work out whether or not you should be doing something in those early years. So particularly when they get into that kind of 3 to 6, 3, 4, 5, 6 area, that's when the tonsils are expanding, so that's when you see most troubles occurring.
So it's not like, I remember when I was young, I used to get tonsillitis a lot, but they wouldn't take them out because it had to be, I don't know, 10 times a year or something like that. Is that changed now? That's not a thing.
I'm going to shock you with what I'm going to say here. Back in the day, if you walked and had tonsils, you'd have them removed. Then the paediatricians and a lot of doctors said, hang on, are we removing too many? Let's stop doing it. So no one had it removed. And it's taken us 300 years to get this thing called common sense. And our common sense is if you're getting lots of tonsillitis, then you probably should have it removed.
Do the tonsils do anything?
Yeah, so the function of the tonsils is that they're lymphoid tissue, so they learn infections and immune responses. So when you get a bug or a pollen or an allergy thrown in your tonsils pick them up, they swallow it, they process it, and so it reminds them, next time you get that bug, it goes, right, here's that bug, let's fight it, and I'll just replicate all the antibodies that fight that infection. So they're important in your immune system. But you have tonsils throughout your whole body. So you have tonsils in the back of your throat, in your tongue, all the way down your esophagus, in your swallowing tube. There's tonsils everywhere. The tonsils we talk about are the big tonsils in your throat and your adenoids and your back of your nose. And what they are, they're for helping us develop and grow quickly. And so that's why you have a big bunch of them there. Mm. You rapidly learn them all and they become useless. You don't have to need them for the rest of your life. Oh, so okay. People worry about, if I take them out, does that mean I'm getting infections? Absolutely not. And there's been many studies that have shown that. It's just really just trying to work out whether you should be taking them out when it's actually causing trouble, such as infections or the sleep sort of breathing.
That makes sense. So it's not that it's getting more. Because I wondered, you just hear so many kids now having their tonsils removed or adenoids removed and I think I didn't really hear about this when I was a kid. Like, I didn't really know anyone that had their tonsils out, and if they did, they were them tonsillitis all the time because you had to meet that 10 quota that as well, or whatever it was. But is that why it's just the tables have turned and they realise
that? I think it's getting this common sense parallel of, I think we're, as consumers and as patients, we're a lot more wary about what we're doing. And so we want to have this balanced conversation about what does the evidence show. Is it going to be better or worse for my kid? Is it worth the risk of going through operations? And again, in the old days, anaesthetics and hospital stays and all that were just, I have to say this politely, were not as good as what they are these days. So we live in a really good era. But also, if it's my child, do I want them going through something that they're going to grow out of? Do I want them doing something when they may not need it? Now, if it means that my child's going to sleep better, concentrate better, pick up, then of course you want to get in there and get those things done. If it means it's going to decrease the risk of having other issues later in life, of course you're going to do that. But if you've got the real question you're asking, if you had two of your one child and you duplicated them, you took the tonsils out in one and you left in the other, who's going to be better off in 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years? And the reality of that is that you don't know. Because you've got a crystal ball. But if the one who's getting lots of tonsillitis, 10, 15 infections a year, of course they're going to be better because they have no antibiotics, no time off school, feeling well, feeling better. Similarly, if they're snoring, bedwetting, bruxism or teeth damage, all those things, and of course it's going to be better. So, again, it comes down to this conversation around, yes, they're causing some troubles, and then the next question is it bad enough to say we should be doing something? So, again, rather than doing the Google search, it's really nice to have a conversation with your doctor or professional. And then I always encourage my patients to actually talk to their GP as well, because once they've seen me, then they can have a chat with their GP and it's kind of away from me and with each other, say, is this something that we want to consider? And generally they come to a good idea of what it is. And the other part of that is that you see the back end of that. When they've had their surgery, they're sleeping better, they're concentrating better, they come back and go, oh, thank you, that was so nice, and they're so happy and really appreciative. So it's really nice. Everyone in the family sleeping.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Everyone and they said the husband's in. At your feet. You must get some nice Christmas presents from patients. They're like, oh, now I can sleep. That's How can cute. I ever repay you?
Well, the cutest thing is the kids, because the kids always draw you pictures and stuff, and I think that brings such a smile when they're coming back in happy. It's really cute.
Yeah. And can you explain what grommets are?
So grommets are tubes you put in your eardrum. Let me go back a step. When you get otitis media or ear infections, you're getting fluid in your middle ear. The best way to think about your middle ear is like a kitchen sink. The kitchen sink is always empty and there's a drain that goes out. And so if you put a drum on top of it, a drum skin on top of your kitchen sink, so you can bang a drum, it makes a really nice echoing loud sound. If you then fill that kitchen sink up with water, the drum won't work, so it doesn't bang very well. And so in kids, otitis media is where you actually get your drainage pipe blocked up and it's not working. So you can't drain the water out of your kitchen sink, and so it's always full of fluid. Now, again, what we're talking about before is that fluid in your middle ear doesn't necessarily need to get infected, but because it's connected to nose, it often gets infected. But fluid in there alone will then stop you from hearing and stop you from developing very well, but also can impair your balance. And so a grommet is a little tube that helps that drainage. So you put a little hole in that eardrum and you remove all that fluid. It lets out an aerate, which then lets you hear. So the function of grommet is to aerate the middle ear to get you hearing better. Not fix the problem of infections, not fix the problem of all the other things that are going on in your station tube dysfunction. Age will do that by itself. The only reason we're doing it is to make sure the kids can hear so they can develop and do well. And so if you think of that that kitchen sink full of fluid. It can either be clear fluid, turbid fluid, thick, gunky fluid, all those kind of things. And some of the, it's a shame it's a podcast because I'd show you some great videos of stuff you suck out of these ears. And it's that really thick, slimy, grimy stuff. And it's wonderful. And you know when it's a good result because you're going to recovery. And the older kids, so the 5-year-old kids you do this on, you go talk to the parents and they often sit there going, "Stop yelling, Mum. You're too loud. You're embarrassing me." And it's really cute. Or, you know, all the different sounds. I had one kid come back where they were living next door to a house that had some creative language. And so the kids started swearing at home. They're going, "What have you done to my kid? They can swear now." It's like, they didn't realise because the kid couldn't hear all the swearing before.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. But so you hear all these cute stories all the time. And so it's wonderful because then you realise how much of you sound on. And again, I go back to we're talking about speech and language in school. But the reality is that fun part of being part of life where you hear that stuff, they hear the bands, they hear the stuff going on in the car, so the kid's not ignored in the car or, you know, not excluded at school with the other kids.
Is a grommet's like a fairly new thing?
Yeah, so the grommets of, a grommet then is a tube that you put into the ear. So if you make a cut in the eardrum and suck all the fluid out, the eardrum will close over within 24 or 48 hours very quickly. So by sucking fluid out, you're actually not doing any service to the kid because it'll close over straight away. So then they started using all different types of instruments to keep your ear open. They use chicken bones or weird things in the past. But now we use a fluoroplastic device which can be inserted in there. And depending on the shape of the grommet will depend on how long it lasts for. So we can make grommets that last for a week. We can make grommets that last for 6 weeks. But the most common is about 12 months or thereabouts, and then we can make them last longer than that if we want to.
I remember hearing, like, when I was a kid, people being like, they'd get grommets and then they'd fall out.
Mm.
Like, "Oh, my grommets fell out."
And so they do. So they should fall out by themselves over a period of time. So often you'll get your grommet put in and then I won't see them again for 12 months unless they're getting infections or left to have any troubles. Mm. And then they'll fall out by themselves. And the question will be whether they need reinserting of the grommets. Remembering that the grommets don't solve the problem of the fluid. The age does. So all these kids turn 7 or 8, I lose all my friends. And it's really cute because they all grow up this age. You see them all grow up to a stage where they're getting to that 7 where they're really talkative and then they don't need them anymore. So it's us getting to that stage of making sure they reach their learning milestones.
Do you think, is like our ear shape changing over time, or did we just used to live with this back in the day and not know and not do anything about it?
No, it's always a problem. It's been a problem for many years. And you go back to literature, you can see that it all occur. Certainly in Indigenous circles, some of the nunkries or traditional healers used to get little sticks with hot ash on them and actually put them in there to they'll do perforations and it'd relieve it, because when you've got a bulging eardrum and you make a cut in the eardrum and let all that pus out, it's so relieving. It is the best feeling well. So kids who used to get all these infections would build up, then they'd burst their eardrum. Then they'd suddenly be happy, but then the parents would be really worried because there's all this stuff coming out of the ears. So it's been around for many years before, but what would normally happen is just perforate in other places. We don't see the complications that we used to see, certainly even in my training days, but even further back than that, where we'd have infections of the brain, infections of the balance apparatus, mastoiditis, big ear operations, cholesteatomas, all these weird, wonderful things which are complications of grommets, of otitis media. Whereas a grommet, placing a grommet in, actually relieves that fluid, relieves all that infection, so they don't get any of those troubles. So, you know, I might have a patient say, "You know, this is my third set of grommets here, I really need it. I'd much rather put 3 sets of grommets in than to do an operation where I drill behind the ear and drill all that mastoid bone out because of complications of these." So we do see it.
Gosh. And so for someone that suspects that their kid has maybe a mild ear infection, you know, maybe went swimming too much or something, what is like the recommendation? Because I feel like you used to go to the GP and they would just always give you antibiotics, but now I've heard that's not the best practice for an ear infection. Is that correct?
So just correct some of the language.
Yeah, sorry. I really butchered that.
There is a middle ear infection and an outer infection. Mm-hmm. Where we live in beautiful water country, we get a lot of outer infections, which is due to swimming.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is otitis media, which is a middle ear infection. Mm-hmm. And so going back to my analogy before is that the sink is full of fluid. Fluid itself is not infected.
Mm.
You do not need antibiotics for fluid.
This is for the middle ear.
For the middle ear.
Okay.
So overcoming the middle ear infection, because it's called otitis media, they still call it an infection of the ear, but it's actually fluid in the ear.
Mm.
So if it's just fluid in the ear, fluid should resolve by itself. So most kids will get this at some time in their life. if you left the fluid alone, they get a cold or flu, they get fluid in the middle ear. After 4 weeks, 85% of the kids will lose that fluid. After 6 weeks, that number goes up to about 92%. And so after 6 weeks, there's still fluid there. That's when we talk about whether we should be doing something or not. But more to the point then is that if it becomes infected, when we say infection, systemic illness, fevers, temperatures, grizzly bum, that's when you want to give antibiotics. If they've actually just got fluid in there, there's no point giving it because it's not going to change anything. And so you look at all the studies that we've done in that. If you had two kids with fluid in their ears and you gave them both antibiotics, they resolved the fluid exactly the same time. So there's no benefit in giving antibiotics. Where we did find the antibiotics better is when they started getting systemically unwell or sick, because they're the ones that are going to perforate. They're the ones that are going to have complications of otitis media. So they're the ones to be careful of. And I think our understanding of that is getting better, and also our ability to diagnose that is getting better. In the past, you didn't have the wonderful otoscopes you have, but now, you know, I have little video cameras that I give all my health workers, so they're taking photos of it and diagnosing it or sending me the photos so they can actually say, does this need antibiotics? And there's a wonderful app that we use called Otitis Media Guidelines. We actually go through all those things for GPs and health professionals to actually work their way through and make sure they can understand what they're doing.
That's good to know. And we know that you do a lot of amazing work in the community and Indigenous communities specifically. Can you share a little bit about what it is that you do? And also, I know there's quite a disparity in terms of the access to health services and health outcomes among Indigenous communities, which I know you're quite passionate about.
I think where my passion is equity and care. And I think certainly from my experience growing up and what I'm seeing is that we're not seeing, we've got a real dichotomy in Australia where you've got the haves and have-nots. What's interesting, particularly with ear disease, and we see this from, so with our item numbers, which are numbers we use for Medicare to see what we're doing ear surgery-wise, so grommets, for example, there's a number for that. So at any one point in time, we can tell where grommets are being done and how many grommets are being done. It's no surprise to most health professionals, but maybe surprising to your listeners, that if you live in an affluent suburb, have private health insurance, then your grommet rate is sky high and your kids are doing really well. No surprise there, because that's what a health system should be. Compare that to regional Australia, remote Australia, where we have the worst ear disease probably in the world, and the ear disease intervention rate is probably 2 a year. So it's a huge disparity in saying that. So under the same country where we look after our health system, we're seeing a real disparate area of access. The problem with that is that, generally speaking, we all migrate to urban populations. Us being in beautiful Newcastle, a good example of that. You know, we live in a really good area, great hospitals, great health infrastructure. Where you move to Tamworth, Armidale, Alice Springs, Mutitjulu, Central Australia, Kimberley's, you know, they're sitting further and further away from ear health care, and so therefore access to it becomes harder. Confounding all that is that there are other health issues, employment issues, work issues. So when your kid's not hearing all that well or got a cute little lisp on them, who cares? Not a big issue. Whereas what we're trying to flip around is that if it's your kid and they're falling behind, how do we actually change that? Because what we want to do is that every kid in Australia should have the ability to dream whatever they want to dream of, and they should have the ability to do whatever they want to do and not be dictated by where they live or what health access they get. And so all the work that I've been doing is really trying to challenge those paradigms, but also challenge the way in which our health professionals are looking at that. So it's not just, I think when I first started doing medicine, and I was always like, how can I help and contribute? The better way we can help is if we make everyone aware, because that means we're all on the same page and we try and bring the whole community along the way. And so for us here, that if we get ear disease well looked after in Newcastle, there's some really good examples of that which I can talk about, then we can apply that to all Australia and all kids better based on how good our kids are. And that's pretty cool, because that means everyone gets better for this. And so I think when I'm talking to a lot of people about it, they go, you know, why don't you come to our community or do this? Say, well, you know, I want to make it right for everyone. If we can actually get in there and get everyone involved in that, it's really cool. And when you see these kids and the amount of enthusiasm, the amount of energy, the amount of ability they have, you know, I'm sure I've met our next president in some of these regional remote communities. It's beautiful. And the value add for me is that, you know, we live in the most beautiful country, and I still say to this day that I've been to places where a lot of people have not been to. I know we've spoken about, you know, up in the Kimberleys and stuff, some of the places up there I've been to are just amazing. You know, I've seen artwork which has been dated at 15,000 years old. Like, you're sitting in front of a rock and seeing artwork that said this is 15,000 years old, and not many people are seeing it because the kids I look after take me and show me things. That's pretty cool, and, you know, it's a wonderful part to be a part of this country that we're in. And so when we're sharing that knowledge together, we're all learning from each other, and I think that's pretty cool.
I love that. I just can't even put it into context, 15,000 years, and then here we are.
Well, when I went and saw that painting, I'd just come back from Europe and seen some, you know, amazing art galleries and that, and that's how these are. And I was in the Kimberleys in remote Kimberley area. And to see in the East Kimberley some of these artworks, and I think, wow, there's no queue, there's no art gallery, this is just there and people don't know. And in a way you don't want people to know because it will stay so beautiful and ruin it. But we have that in here, you know, and that's how I was talking to some of my aunties and uncles in this area. And, you know, on Warramai country only a month ago, you know, I've seen some artwork that we've been dating back to probably 5,000 years ago. And so to see some of that stuff and to see some of the ability of our communities back then is just phenomenal in our own backyard. And I was talking to my son recently about some of that stuff, and we went out to Broughton Island, which is close by. I don't know if you guys know that area there. But because it's an island away from us, it used to be attached to the coast, a lot of stuff's still quite primitive. So we're finding so much stuff, which is really cool to see that's in our own backyard.
Love it. Kelvin, thank you so much for your time. For you've had such a big and busy day, and we really loved picking your brain.
Oh, it's been fun chatting. Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Such an honour, and you do amazing work that we're so grateful for, and I know that the wider community is too. So thank you very much for all that you do.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was fun.
Thanks, Kelvin.
Thank you for listening to Boob to Food, the podcast. We hope this episode made you feel inspired, confident, and less overwhelmed in your parenting journey.
Head to the show notes for all the resources mentioned on today's episode. And if you loved this podcast, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review.
See you next week. Bye.